Hi, is this Arnold Newman?
Yes.
Hi, this is Eve Schaub.
Who's this?
Eve Schaub. I was calling to do the interview for PhotoVision.
Oh, yes. Do you want to start?
Yeah, if this is still a good time for you.
It's never a good time, but go ahead.
Are you sure?
I'm here.
All right. I was wondering if it's all right with you if I use a tape recorder.
Of course.
Okay. Great. Okay. My first question was I wanted to ask you about finding a way to straddle the line between fine art and commercial. It's obviously an issue that all artists struggle with, but you managed to make it look easy, and I wondered how you do it.
Well, it's very simple. You just do the best job every time you can. And most of the people who want my work are generally the kind who say, we want your kind of photograph. And a lot of my things I did for ads, particularly for the New York Times series. There was a whole series of ads, a lot of them are in museums. I don't have a line that I put down and say, this is commercial and this is my so-called artwork.
Mm-hmm.
I just do the best damn job I do every time.
I wanted to thank you for recommending your new book, because I did manage to get it.
Oh, good. And where'd you get it?
What's that? I got it on Amazon.
Uh-huh.
And it was a terrific resource, very comprehensive, of you and all your work.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the appendix. There are all these wonderful images where that lend insight into your background and your working method, showing you in different shoots. And I love the fact that you included the drawings from your art school period between 37 and 38, and then your holiday greeting card photo from 1940. I thought that was terrific. It would have been really fascinating to see some of your other work that you might not have wanted to include in the book, like...
It wasn't that I didn't want to.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, it was agony to leave, have to cut it down to just, I think it's about 155 or 154 images.
Uh-huh.
I mean, big images. At one time, we were doing it, doing their brick book, and we were selecting 671. And it was agony to cut it down from that. Believe me, it's almost difficult, impossible to say these are the best and that sort of thing. Because sometimes you have to make a balance between an abstraction, some abstractions, some portraits, and so on, and color and so forth.
I wish that you were able to include some of your fashion work, though, even if it was just one or two images, because I was really curious to see that. I know you didn't like that.
Well, it wasn't that I didn't like doing the fashion, it was I didn't like the atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the atmosphere was extremely artificial and even unbelievably ridiculous at times. And it's not my cup of tea, let's put it that way.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the photographs I found, doing my photographs were interesting and all that sort of thing. The main point of that was some of the people were just unbelievable and ridiculous.
So I was surprised none of those images made their way into the book somewhere.
Well, I just didn't, I guess I didn't select them.
Uh-huh.
I never thought of that.
Do you still have any of the 49-cent portraits that you did at the very beginning?
I don't know where they are. They're probably in somebody's great-grandchildren's home or something. It was my great-grandmother or something. Don't forget I did those things in 1938 and 39.
Oh,
but I mean, they didn't even belong to me, and I didn't care for them.
Yeah. Do all those different experiences, do you think they all come into play in your working method?
Oh,
today?
Absolutely. I mean, my art background, ever since I can remember, I wanted to draw. And I, you know, automatically learned the whole history of painting and art. And also got a little interested in photography. I never thought I'd be a photographer. And then when I went out to take my first picture, I realized instantly there was a big technical and creative and psychological difference between a painting and a photograph. I mean, all these things help. And even doing these 49-cent pictures, I had to learn to put people at their ease, you know, almost instantly, particularly when you're doing 40, 50 a day.
That sort of leads me to another question that I had, which, because you were a student of painting and art history, and you were familiar with all the figures of the art world, like Picasso and Braque, people you would later be photographing, did you ever have that sense of intimidation and think to yourself, you know, Picasso, I can't photograph Picasso, you know?
Well, I don't know. I just felt I wanted to. If you're afraid photographing people, whether it be Picasso, the President of the United States, or some Prime Minister, if you're uncertain and don't know what you're doing, or at least your fear of doing them shows that, they're not going to give you much time. I mean, I'm aware of who these people are. I'm very respectful, but I have to direct them. I have to say what I want. It has to be me, or else it's not a picture. I mean, like in the present movie, a picture didn't show me taking it, but actually they showed the photograph I did for Life magazine of Jackson Pollock. And they showed, and I wasn't there while they were filming it, although they invited me. It was 3 a.m. I said, the heck with it. They showed Lee Pollock's wife posing him. I would have thrown her the hell off the set, and I know Lee wouldn't have done it in the first place. But they just assumed she did, so go figure that one out. Or did I make myself clear?
No, yeah.
I have to be in control all the time, and it was rather strange. I'd already photographed presidents and people before I photographed Picasso, and I never felt nervous.
Really? There was never a subject that you felt intimidated by?
Well, the very first one, some little woman who came in the first time I had to take a picture. She was wringing her hands and frightened as hell, and I was slightly nervous. The first commercial portrait I'd ever did. I was being a professional, I should say. I took one look, I said, no use two of us being nervous, so I stopped being nervous.
You said something about being in control, needing to be in control of the situation, and it reminds me of that photograph that's also in the appendix where you're photographing the pushpin group, and you're sort of in the center, and you're directing everyone, and you're holding up what looks like a pointer, and everyone's sort of circled around you. You've got assistants and equipment.
I didn't have a pointer.
I don't know what it is in your hand. There's something that some little baton-like thing in your hand, and it reminded me of like a conductor, and I was wondering if you ever see yourself that way as sort of orchestrating the scene.
You know, you get a number of people together, you have to. I don't know, I don't conduct people with a stick. I just say, can you move over? And you just turn this way or that way. Most of the time I let them do what they want, and they sat down. It was marvelous, and I just kept pushing them around a little bit. Say, can you move over, or maybe you can lean forward, or something like that. It's the same way with the pushpin group as it is with an individual, a president of the United States, or somebody else. Say, can you sit over here, sir, and all that sort of thing. Then they get bored, and then they just relax. And for most people, I'd say, if you move, I'll kill you. Of course, you don't say that to the President of the United States, particularly in front of the Secret Service. Although once, I forget who it was, I think it was Ford, who was a very nice guy, although he didn't agree on politics. And he was talking, I finally said, Mr. President, I'm the only one around here who can tell you to keep your mouth shut. But you you have to know when you're joking and all of that, and you have to have a feel for the person and the situation before you do stupid things.
Well, that was one of my other questions, was I was wondering, you know, especially when you're photographing someone like the President of the United States, mm-hmm. you know, you talk about wanting to have this sort of what was it? You mentioned in the essay at the beginning of the book, you say that your subjects are often the kind of people you like to have long conversations with until late at night over dinner and wine.
Exactly.
And I thought, well, the President of the United States, how much time do you really get to interact with him and have that develop?
Well, not much. Because obviously they're very busy people. And I generally ask for upwards of an hour, and then when they stop fainting, I mean, his aides, of course, settle on 30 minutes or something like that, and we generally take upwards of 45 to 50 or 60 minutes. I remember when Johnson asked me to do his official portrait, I had photographed him before, and he always gave me trouble. And you have to speak up to these people, particularly somebody like Johnson. If you were scared to death and you were cringing or something, he'd dismiss you in 2 seconds. Not that you stand up, but you say, this is what I think we have to do. I'm sorry, Mr. President, or else we're not going to have a picture made. And then he'll go along with you. And when I was doing this official portrait, he came out and he said, I'm giving you 15 minutes. I said, Mr. President, I think I need some more time. He says, well, 15 minutes, keep it short. It was all over. He looked at his watch. He said, God damn it, Newman, you took 45 minutes. And I looked at him and I smiled and I said, I know, Mr. President. He knew that I knew. It's a matter of getting people to understand you're on their side and you're a professional. I tell students all the time that if you show that you're nervous or you don't know what you're doing, they're going to dismiss you instantly. It's like having an employee who doesn't know what they're doing. You can't have them around. And if I'm wasting their time or appears like I'm wasting their time not knowing what I'm doing, they're going to ask me and say, this is it. Mm-hmm. Although once I had an executive downtown, he was in one of the big offices downtown in Manhattan, and I was astonished after about 10 minutes or whatever, it was maybe 7 minutes, he said, that's enough, you got enough pictures, and he literally said, I can't give you any more time. And I said, sir, you're paying for this, he was commissioning me to do them. He said, you got enough pictures. So I put the pictures together. It was a good one. I left it out. Because sometimes I've taken my best pictures in the first 2 or 3, 4 minutes. And, of course, this guy, I was doing him in color, and he was fidgeting around, and I didn't really get anything that was really good at all. So I sent him down the proofs. And he called, and he said, these are terrible proofs. These are terrible pictures. I said, I'll tell you what, I'd like to come down and you show me what's wrong with him. And I went down to his office, and he must have spent 20 minutes telling me what was wrong with my pictures. I said, Mr. Smith, whatever his name was, I said, you know, you spent twice as much time telling me what was wrong with the pictures than you gave me taking them. And I said, this is what I was trying to tell you. And he looked at me and he says, you're right, Mr. Newman. So he arranged, he paid for the second sitting, and he gave me plenty of time, and he was very happy with the results. I mean, it's a matter of being, you know, you not only have to be an artist, you also have to be a professional.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. You should quote me on that.
Is there such a thing as a typical shoot?
A what?
A typical shoot?
Not really. I mean, I most of my things are all done under different circumstances. Almost everything I do is on location, although occasionally when I have no other choice, I do it in my studio. And, well, you go about trying to find out as much as you can about everybody you want to photograph. I mean, presidents and people like that, there's plenty of information. But then you want to know, where is the place physically? What does it look like? What's the opportunity for taking pictures? What will be the best kind of a atmosphere or background or what environment that he works in, and can you do it? And then you may come up with a surprise, or it'll be just what you want, or it might be agony trying to find something. I remember once when I had to photograph Oppenheimer, and the editors thought I'd get a very dramatic picture. After all, he was president. He was the inventor of the A-bomb, and he was the head of this whole thing out there in New Mexico. And they thought maybe in front of cyclotrons. I don't know what they expected. This is for Fortune magazine.
With atomic bombs going off in the background, you know. Atomic bombs going off in the background.
Yeah. Well, you know, good. I don't think they really expected that. It would have been interesting. Who knows? We both of us would have been killed unless we were 100 miles away. But the point was, as I got there and I met him, and I was very dubious about what. I didn't know whether to ask him to see the labs and things. So I met him up in the eaves of the science building out in Berkeley, where my youngest son went eventually. And I said, Dr. Oppenheimer, where do you work? He says, I work wherever I am with paper and pencil. Now, one of the things I always say, and it's the same thing with scientists, you don't take pictures with your cameras. You take them with your heart and your mind. The camera is nothing more than a tool. And what he told me, what Oppenheimer told me, and that's a very important quote of mine, I say it all the time, that he worked wherever he was with paper and pencil. He was thinking out what he wants. The bomb going off did nothing more than prove out what he put on paper and pencil. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
And he showed me his desk. He had some books around, and it was a rather bare thing. You wouldn't know it was a great Oppenheimer's office. And he looked at me, we got chatting, and he said, what are you doing for lunch? I said, I had no plans for lunch. He said, why don't you come home with me? We're having lunch there. So it was just he and my assistant, which happened to be my brother, who came up to visit me, so I took him instead of my assistant. It was a good excuse to travel. At that time, he was in Florida, I was in New York, and we first had to do a story in New Orleans. Then we went up the West Coast, where we did a number of scientists, including Oppenheimer. So we chatted for a while, and I recognized across the room a Van Gogh that he had, and he was so pleased that I could recognize something that had never been reproduced or shown before, he told me. Because it was, to me, it was obvious. I mean, a photographer must have an eye like a painter has an eye. It's the same thing. You know, we're visual artists. And I said, well, if he only works, I said to myself, with paper and pencil, what'll I do? And he said, well, I said, where do you work here at home? He said, out here. And he had a large wooden table outside under the eaves of the side of his house. And it was in the shade. And it's in the book.
Yes.
And I photographed him there. Now, I forget which one, or is it two that I put in the book? I forget.
I remember one.
Well, one with a very thin line on the left. I believe that was it. Anyhow, there it was. And my background enabled me to simplify it by my knowledge of Japanese prints.
Ah. And they were, you said they were looking for something more dramatic than that.
Oh, the editors were pleased as punch.
Oh, they were.
They understood exactly. They trusted me. They understood exactly what I was driving at. And it was more abstract than they expected, but But they understood the picture immediately. As a matter of fact, the art director, Will Burton, at that time at Fortune magazine, I understand that when his one of he showed exactly how he wanted it on the page, he turned it over to a layout man who thought the line was an accident to the edge of the film, so he cut it off. I was told the whole building shook when Will Burton found that. He understood. He said, "You put that damn line. That damn line actually was the door." And I understand they could hear him all over the Time Life building shouting at this layout man who didn't understand what I was doing.
That must be something that comes up a lot for you.
Well, a lot of people would want to crop them, and I said, "You can't." No, most of the time they don't. That's what I think. Because when they do, we scream and yell, or they ask permission, or I work it out with them.
Have you had problems with copyright issues of images just appearing and without?
Well, everybody's had some. You know, we've had lawyers' letters, and they've all generally paid up and all that sort of thing. We have that with a lot of people. Right now, a man has put out a book. He's a scientist. No, he's an art critic. I'm not going to go on it. Photograph of a painter on the cover of a book, and he just thought it was so wonderful, I should be pleased, and also because he's a scholar, I shouldn't charge him anything. And when I saw a copy of a red what do you call it, the make ready book, he didn't give me credit. And so, so we're sicking the world on him. He's in trouble, and he's begging me now to not be so difficult. And he's, you know, I'm supposed to accept that, you know, be honored. We've all been through that. I'm one of the original people, not the only one, that started fighting it way back in the early days of ASMP.
That just seems like such a pervasive problem right now, and it almost seems like you could never get to the end of, you know, there's always going to be somebody out there doing something like that.
Oh, I've been told that stories on me have been run in China without any credit payment. Mm-hmm. I mean, with credit, a story about me, without permission and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Several places where we don't have copyright agreements, somebody told us, group of us the other day, China, Russia, two or three other places. But in general, there's an international copyright agreement. Actually, I've had less trouble than you would think.
Really? Because your images are just so well-known and sort of epitomize certain figures. I would think that people would almost feel that they had, you know, that they just belong to everyone, because they're so well known.
Well, we do run into that on occasion.
I had another question, which had to do with a comment you made in the introduction in your essay, where you say that most of your photographs are not of famous people. But of course, you know, almost all the images in the book, all the portraits, seem to be well-known people. What did you mean by that?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the pictures I do of people that are not famous, it's hard to explain why I did it. And so we'd sort of fallen into the habit of showing people the way I photograph them, and they would understand if they understood about the person that I photograph.
Mm-hmm.
You see. And I've taken many pictures of not-so-famous people, number one. There's another one. There's quite a number of pictures in there of the people who were not famous when I photographed them.
Ah.
Some of the artists.
Ah, okay.
And there are even some scientists who I happened to photograph and then later become major figures and things like that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because...
But let me put it this way. Uh-huh. It's true that most of the people I do are known because that's where I get most of my commissions. And mm-hmm. people are not going to say Joe Blow and all of that. And I keep hoping that one day I'll have enough time to do a whole series of pictures of my neighbors and the people who run the grocery stores and, you know, all that sort of thing.
But that leads me to another question I had, which was...
And by the way, I've done that sort of thing, and it is in some of my books.
Uh-huh. Do you ever photograph your family?
Pardon?
Do you ever take portraits of your family?
Oh, sure.
Because they seem to figure prominently.
Get it over with, Dad. Let's get this done. You know, no respect.
I was surprised not to see more images of your wife or your children or your grandchildren.
Well, they were nice snapshots. I do have one. I don't know. I have one of my younger son, which I think is as good as anything I've ever done. And maybe the next book I'll put it in, but somehow or other they said, well, you know, so-and-so is so famous, and you did such a great job showing who he is, that you can't drop that for the picture of your son.
Mm-hmm.
Because the picture of my son is slightly abstract. And also my sons live halfway across the country and all the way across the country. And it's a hell of a problem to spend a lot of time doing it, you know, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Back to talking about famous people, I think you make reference to the fact that you don't just take photographs of famous people, but they're sort of a particular type of famous person that you specialize in. They're all artists and writers and scientists and politicians.
If anybody has ever accomplished anything.
Right, right. People who are not just celebrities, but who have actually...
Oh, God, I hate that word.
Well, it shows, because you don't have a lot of movie stars or models. In fact, the only one that I found was Marilyn Monroe. And
well, Marilyn, she became a small part of my life at one point. I went out to work with Carl Sandburg to do a book, which unfortunately, because of his illness, never got done. And he was out in Hollywood, and to get the book started, I flew out there. A friend of mine canceled my hotel room and made me stay with him. He wanted me to stay with him, and he was the producer at 20th Century that was doing the film on Marilyn.
Oh.
And he wanted me to photograph Marilyn. I photographed an awful lot of, I've done a lot of that sort of thing, and some of them are good, and they're in costume and things like that. He wanted me to photograph Marilyn, but Marilyn kept putting it off and putting it off while I was out there. And we had several evenings together where she was my dinner date. It was funny, the first time her analyst, which wasn't supposed to do this, would take her to invite her to his home to be with his family. He felt that she needed a family. And so I was supposed to leave on a Saturday, and this was Saturday night, so he called my wife. He says, Arnold can't come home tonight. He'll be home tomorrow night. Tonight he's got a date with Marilyn Monroe. But believe me, there was one woman I would never want, even if I was unmarried, I would never want to be mixed up with. She was a very sad, confused woman.
That definitely comes across in your photograph.
Yes. Hold on one second.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Where are you calling from?
Vermont.
Can you hold on a second here, or else I can write a check for him if you want. Wait a minute, that's really crazy. What bill does he have there? I've been using this credit card now.
It's... No. Yeah, he might be using your old.
Where did he get it? I gave him this. Tell him to come in here. Can you hold on?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
On my card.
Oh.
They were. So go ahead.
How about the portrait of Woody Allen on the cover? I thought that was an interesting choice.
Well, it was a little difficult to figure out which one. They wanted, and so did I agreed, they wanted somebody that would be recognized, you know, in current culture.
Mm-hmm.
And Woody agreed, and we used it. We thought of several, and he became the number one choice, and apparently we made the right choice by using him. But, you know, you go through the book, you decide what's in the book, and then you say, what do we do for the cover? And that's how it happened. Actually, Woody is not, you know, it's a tiny part of an environmental thing. You know, my Stravinsky certainly is an environmental portrait. It's enough, if you want to give it a label, and I hate labels, it's symbolic. And with Woody, I found that he did all his writing in bed. He writes his own scripts, and he agreed, and he thought that was a good idea, and I did full lengths. I showed the whole bed with a canopy and all that sort of thing on the bed.
Oh.
And the closer I came and the more I cropped, the better I liked it.
I thought it was interesting to put that on the cover as opposed to the Stravinsky or
of
the other.
I don't want to do that again. It was three times or something before on the cover of books.
Yeah. I had a and also the fact that Woody Allen is sort of a controversial figure, at least in recent years. I thought that it was an interesting choice to put him on.
No, I didn't even think of that. I mean, because he married a girl young enough to be his granddaughter.
Yeah.
At least his daughter. He was technically his daughter, or actually it wasn't, because what's her name adopted her without his name on it.
Right, right. Yeah, so because he had been in the news for stuff like that,
yeah.
I thought it was sort of an interesting choice to put him on, but it's one of my favorite images. I really like it.
Oh, well, thank you.
I wanted to ask you about, I went through the book and I was struck by the number of men as opposed to women. There's an awful lot more men than women shown in the book, and I was wondering if you had any idea why that might be.
You know, I didn't really think of that. I started out 62 years ago. That's going on 63. But I didn't start doing my kind of work until 3 years later. Almost in every field, women were not particularly prominent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to tell you all the things about that. Although I didn't start photographing them where they were.
Mm-hmm.
I think today about 50% of my subjects are women.
Really?
And, you know, and that sort of thing. But there's still, not maybe not that much, but I'm a great women's liberal.
Concern.
I always swore that I wouldn't marry a woman who wasn't smarter than I was. We've been married 52 years, and she's still smarter than I am. She's run my studio, but she did things on the outside which have been incredible. And she also was beautiful enough to be asked when we let everybody know we're getting married. you know, editors from Life and from Harper's Bazaar looked at her and asked me, just said, do you think she'd be interested in modeling? At least trying it.
Huh.
And when I asked her that, she said, you want that nonsense? You want a family. And what's even more important, when I met her, she was smuggling guns.
Smuggling guns?
Yeah, I don't know. Didn't I mention that in my text?
No. I would have remembered that.
Well, it's a slightly complicated story. She's an American girl, came from Chester, Pennsylvania. Find her way in New York. And instantly she was always hired. And she came from, we're Jewish, and she came from a Zionist family, if you know what that is. The family that always felt that eventually the remnants of the Jews, particularly in our time, would have to go to Palestine. And this was right after the war and after the Holocaust, but neither one of us lost family there. We were lucky. But you know, many of our friends lost their whole families, wiped out totally. 40-some-odd were just, you know, killed, butchered, went in up these chokes, smokes.
Yes.
And in Auschwitz and other places. So she was sort of steered when people began to realize of her interest. She worked for Stephen Wise, her first job, who is one of the great political rabbis, of, you know, like a cardinal would be here in New York. And although he's also a great rabbi. And she worked as his secretary for a while. And then she said she wanted to do something more for the Jews fleeing and trying to get into Palestine. And so he gave her his blessing, and she went down to one place for sending food over there and an agriculture machinery and things like that. And they steered her to a secret headquarters. Now, before the war, before Israel became a state, you could buy anything all over the whole world. Guns, ammunition, airplanes, machine guns, you name it. And for pennies, because the war was just over. This was 1947 and 48. I met her in 48. Actually, I think it started in 46, this whole thing. And Ben-Gurion, who is the leader of the community, and knew that something that, and he was told, and they broadcast it and everything else, their leader, who was Hitler's guest during the war, said, declare a state, we will slaughter the babies, we will first rape the women, then kill them, and then push everybody into the sea. We want everything. So he knew there would be a war, because they said there would be a war. So, but the problem was, you can buy everything you wanted for pennies, but you were, the international agreement was you couldn't take it out of the country as an embargo. So they set up a secret headquarters. You could have gotten put to jail, but I think Truman told them, don't do anything. And they were, this office was across the way from me. It was all the way over on the other side of town, but on 60th Street, off Central Park West. And there they set up a secret headquarters where they never telephoned out anything like that. But they had people around them. There's about 10, 12 people that was in the office, and many people around them, about 15. I have no idea at this point. And they were directing how they were being, things were being smuggled out of the country under false things. I think we all think that Truman knew and told the FBI, lay off. And I think the world more or less had that feeling, because they felt the remnants of the Holocaust were making their way. Although I knew families there that had been there for hundreds, maybe since biblical times. People forget that. You know, the Jews never left. Mm-hmm. So she was working there. Now that explains everything. How I met her and how I thought this was all so suspicious, because it was a place where some of the girls, it was sort of a second-rate hotel where the girls worked out of. It was a nightclub in the bottom. God, I thought maybe she was a high-class gal. Christ girl, I should have said. Because on my first time I asked her for a date, she said, I may have to get back to work at 11. I said, what? Turns out, later I found out that meant the boat was going out that night, and they all had to hang around until they got out safely.
Ah.
So we've never lived an uneventful life. Our lives have been full of excitement all the way through.
She sounds like she's been a really great influence in your life.
Oh, yes. I mean,
and your work.
From that, I became very involved with Israel. I always was interested, of course, but by this way I had connections all the way up to the top. I've done a lot of stories there for all the magazines, Life, Look, Holiday, particularly Holiday, and whether you remember it, was one of the best magazines to work for.
No, I didn't know Holiday, no.
And you're in photography? I'm serious. You go back and see if you can find old Holidays. We wandered all over the world. It wasn't for people just having fun, We even do stories about the Louvre and about the Vatican, things like that. Those are the sort of stories I did for them. Or I do portraits of the heads of countries, things like that. And Cartier-Bresson, myself, David Douglas Duncan, a whole bunch of us worked for them.
Huh. And when did Holiday cease to be?
Oh, I think it was in the late 70s, early, early 70s. I really forget. The problem there was is that they belonged to the, the Saturday Evening Post, the whole, that group.
Mm-hmm.
And a man came in, and it was making money, not a hell of a lot. A man was secretly buying up all the stock. Oh, this had very little to do with me. He was buying up all the stock of these owners who were so rich, they felt, well, instead of living off our income, which went into the millions, we want a bigger yacht, so I'll just sell off a few pieces of stock, which was worth a lot of money. And he was secretly buying up until he had the majority of stock and threw them all. Families goes back to Benjamin Franklin. He threw them the hell out. It was a very famous scene where he threw them the hell out of their own headquarters over right that one day. They had no idea that this was about to happen. And he dumped all the debts into the magazine making the least amount of money, which was Holiday, and gave it away practically. And the rest of them he was able to sell. He sold them piecemeal much higher, like Ladies Home Journal, Saturday Evening Post, which was a great magazine, but it was dying out, and all that sort of thing. But this is the history of the magazines and photographers, and I've lived through all of it. Now, I'm in photography 62 years.
Yeah.
I'm 83, as you can see.
Well, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm being offered a big, huge show in the in Paris at a government-sponsored place. It's what the hell is it called? Patrimoine Photographique or something like that. It's a very prestigious place sponsored by the government, only for photography.
Mm.
I'm trying to do another book of a third. That book was number 13. I'm trying to do my memoirs, trying to get enough pictures taken, trying to keep up with all the orders for prints. I don't know. I'm trying to get my life in order.
Now, do you sell your prints in editions, or how do you do that?
If I'd have sold my prints in editions, I'd be dead broke by now. It's like Ansel, who told me my Stravinsky was my Moonrise. He never numbered those prints. If he did, he wouldn't be able to sell them all his life. And it's funny, two of the most famous prints that are being sold, more prints of those two are being sold, Moonrise, Stravinsky, never was numbered. And we get more money for those, and we sell them more than all the pictures that could possibly be numbered. If I'd have numbered those, even say 250, which is generally the top, the law in the New York State means that I can't make any more. That would have gone off several decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have sold them all off and been crying. What's the next question?
Oh, well, this is my last question, which is, who would you most like to photograph next?
Oh, now come. There's so many people that are exciting.
Oh, you can name a couple.
Well, God, I don't know. Probably just to keep my franchise going, I photographed every president since Truman, and I probably will be doing our present president. I didn't say anything. I've been told that I probably will be able to get in without a problem.
Yeah.
And there's several of them. I've not only cut in on my own name, but I several were my clients.
So they actually...
Sounds important. I sometimes wonder how the hell all this happened.
So they sought you out, as opposed to the other way around.
They knew about me because I'd already photographed them, or, you know, things like that.
Are you the only photographer to have done all the presidents going back this many?
I have no idea, but I suspect it might be true.
Yeah, I think so.
And I've photographed any number of prime ministers in England, and all the prime ministers except the current one, or the one that just left, and the current one in Israel, and I've done a number of heads of states in France, Ethiopia, Germany. See, people start giving me these things, and you have to try not to just use them as a subject matter, but to try to be making interesting pictures, creative pictures.
Well, I see what you mean about researching your subject, because a lot of those people, I wouldn't have the first idea about, you know, what their significance was in their particular country at that particular moment.
Well, here's something else, and I tell this also to students. I photograph people, how do I put it? I photograph people that even if you don't know who they are, you should find the photograph interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's terribly important. And I'll never forget a woman who wanted to buy that picture, and she hesitated. She says, you know, the piano player. Meaning Stravinsky, of course. She had no idea about composers, but she just liked the picture. And, you know, things like that. And a picture should be good enough for you to buy it, even if you don't know who the subject is.
Well, do you think that there's a compelling picture to be made of everyone? Is everyone capable of...
Well, you can try, but of course it doesn't always happen. I mean, it's ridiculous to say that every picture I've ever done is good. I used to have that reputation at Life for a long time. They thought I never made a mistake. Well, I was one of the three photographers who had a separate agreement with them that I processed and printed my own work. If I ever did a bad picture, they never saw it.
They never knew about it.
And that's why they began to think, geez, Newman never makes a good picture.
That sounded like a good deal.
Hmm?
That sounded like a good deal.
Well, it was in those days. I got top price. I came in, they thought I had a big, huge studio in Florida where I went home to go in the Army. I was just barely scraping by. And so they offered me top price and everything else, plus the copyright. And that's something I want to, I think we have to really get together and fight the, whatchamacallits, the magazines at this point, because they not only are paying pennies compared to what they paid before, you know, considering inflation.
Yes.
But they demand that they have all rights to the pictures. And to me, this is unfair, and it's threatening the development of any of the young, good photographers coming along, and there are lots of them.
So,
they have no chance, and they won't be able to earn much of a living, and they'll quit. And they have nothing to fall back on.
And this is different than it used to be.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, if you worked at Life, and you were paid by Life, as you're on staff, I should say, yes, they did agree, but there were, you had different things that they offered you, insurance, health insurance, things like that, separation pay. And I was shocked when I found out one famous photographer, how little he was paid separation pay when he left. I mean, it was pennies. And this was the big corporation. But when 10 of us went on, you see if you could go back and find that book that was put out, I think 10,000 Eyes by ASMP, I wrote a foreword in that explaining how we fought Life magazine when they tried to do that to us back in the 50s, try to take away all our rights.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, they wrote us a letter saying, on notice, saying if you do one more day's work for us, then you give up the rights of everything you've ever done for us. 10 of us held out. top 10 freelancers.
Wow.
After a year, they gave in. Because they needed us as much as we needed them. Although there were other magazines who were not demanding it, so I did very well that year.
So what do you think is going to happen now? Do you think it's possible to have this situation reverse itself now?
Well, I think that most of the magazines are being run by money managers and marketing people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, I know. And it's even beginning to squeeze into the museums, art museums, believe it or not.
Yeah.
There's a book written about that. Created a lot of attention. And in one museum out in the Midwest, I don't want to mention which one, in the order of importance and say-so, they have a money manager on top, and then a couple of people below him that that work for him, and then about third down on the same level as the curators was the director of the museum.
Uh-huh.
And this may happen, and it's just going to stifle them unless somebody wakes up one day or all the photographers wake up and go on strike and say, we're not going to work for you anymore. And of course, most of them can't afford to do that.
Yeah.
And it's a pity.
We have much the same situation even at our small art organizations up here in Vermont. Many of them, you know, they place up in Vermont, where I live.
Oh, I thought you were calling from Iowa.
No, I'm in Vermont.
Oh, you're in Vermont. Why would I get that mixed up?
Yeah, we have very much the same situation where unfortunately, you know, the financial strategist is way more important than the director or the curator or,
exactly.
You know, yeah, it's really a shame.
You know, in the old days, it was, you know, because of they start making a little money on some of these blockbuster things, they figured, hey, let's make some money. Now, the money is more important. Before,
yeah.
People supported it, the public supported it, because they had good museums. And, well, I'll just tell you this in a hurry, but then I remember going to the Metropolitan Museum one day after they bought, well, this is God knows how many years ago, the $2 million Rembrandt.
Yeah.
I think you remember that. I don't know how old you are.
Well, when would that have been?
What's that?
When would that have been? What year?
Oh, maybe 30 years ago.
Oh, I'm afraid I wouldn't remember that then.
That. And you're probably young enough to be my granddaughter, possibly. Well, anyhow, the thing was is that in those days, it's like a $200 million painting for the money bought in those days.
Right.
And they put it up in the downstairs. Have you ever been to the Metropolitan Museum of Art?
Yes.
Well, you know, you enter and there's this huge hall.
Yes.
Well, the way they figured it, they put that right in the middle, and hundreds upon hundreds of people went outside of the down to the steps and all. People waited in line for a fleeting glance as they were allowed to walk past it. They weren't looking at a Rembrandt. They were looking at a $2 million painting. Well, the point was is that I looked down on them. I was on the balcony that looks down on it. And I walked over out of curiosity to see there's two rooms which have Rembrandts. And I don't know, I think they have around a dozen Rembrandts at the Met. There were three people there.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Think about that. They only wanted to see a $2 million painting, but painting could be worth that much money. Why didn't they come upstairs and take a look at the rest of the Rembrandts? Or anything else?
Oh,
this
yeah.
is what most of the people go to see now.
More the spectacle.
My being an old fogey.
No, I think that's a very good point. It's more. That sounds like it's more about the spectacle than anything else. Unfortunately.
Yeah, they always want to say, well, yes, I saw the Vermeer show, or I saw this show, or I saw that show, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there opening night. That's a big thing. I sometimes don't bother going opening night because I want to see the damn thing. Unless it's somebody I know who's show it is, or I know some of my friends will be there. I mean, I loved, a lot of these big, a lot of the painters or photographers who have shows, and I frequently avoid going to the openings. You can't even see the damn.
Oh, yeah, you never see anything at an opening. Everybody's in the way.
You're only there to look important or try to sound important.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was all my questions.
You could do me a favor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, number one, if you would just fax me your name, address, telephone number, and all of that, and or if you're typing it up, I promise, I don't believe in censorship. You can say anything you want about me. But just in case, because there have been a number of these things where it's been embarrassing,
uh-huh.
If you would, if there's a mistake in some fact, I will just suggest, if you want, to correct it. That's all. Like somebody said that Stieglitz gave me my first show, and people thought that I actually said that to the interviewer, who never did show me the text.
Right.
You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Although Stieglitz did take me in, when Beaumont Newell discovered me that day and sent me over to see Stieglitz, and two of them took me in at the age of 23. So I've been pretty lucky. But I don't want anybody to say that this happened or that happened, that didn't.
When it didn't, yeah.
You know, it's rather embarrassing.
Well, so would you like me to fax you this when I get it typed up?
I would love that.
Okay.
And I promise only. Now, I'm going to be away starting Thursday. Well, I don't know whether I'll get in on Thursday. Our plane leaves in the afternoon. And I come back next Monday night.
Okay.
So we're flying out to the West Coast. It's a holiday. And I'll be back on Tuesday if you're doing that in a hurry.
Okay. Would it be all right if I get it to you after you come back?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Or you can send it. I mean, if you need it before, I can send, yes, my son, if you need it before that, my son has a fax in his home.
I don't think there's that much of a hurry on it.
Oh, good. All right.
Yeah.
Then send it to me when you're finished and polish it up.
Okay.
Already?
Terrific.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm delighted you're doing it. Would you be needing reproductions? Did they say anything about that?
He did not tell me what he wanted to do about that.
Okay. But generally they ask. That's the only reason I brought it up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure that Steve Enshaw will contact you about which images he wants to accompany the article.
Okie dokie.
Okay?
Right.
Great. Bye-bye. Thanks so much.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.